Folk, this is the converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell, and you are here with a Tom Petty free-fallen edition of the Metsian podcast. My God, here we go again. It hasn't stacked up yet to a streak of 2010 or 2012 status, but the Mets in either of those years, neither of those years, were they ever in the position that they were in this year. And with the division rival Nationals, albeit one who's a little lacking right now, coming in, as well as the stretch afterwards with the Dodgers and the Giants, I could very well see this piling up into a 2010/2012 post-All-Star break type of stretch. And we're going to get into all of that and more on this edition of the Metsian podcast. And before we bring on our featured guest, let me go around the horn with our co-conspirators in this podcast, and we're going to start in Connecticut with Rich Spirago. Rich, what can I say? I hope you're okay.
No, I'm okay. I think the off night is very helpful. I actually put out a Twitter poll at 7. Says, so what are we thinking, Twitter? Are we thinking, damn, I wish they were playing, or geez, I needed a night off? And as you might imagine, geez, I needed a night off, won by a very comfortable margin. So, I think, you know, with the thing of the week and the day to process it, I think we're all good, ready for some productive Mets talk.
Ready for some productive Mets talk. We took a night. We were going to go tomorrow, but then we were like, you know what, we all need to do our thing and come back tomorrow night on the night off. Going over to Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, Mike LeColant. Mike, do we at least have some Cyclones baseball to look yonder and see some good things happening?
Well, if you're talking about individual players, yes. It's insofar as the team and the season, not so much. So, you know, like parent,
well, first,
like offspring,
first year in new division. First year in new division, and we can certainly at some point get into some minor league talk because around the horn, that might be better than what we have to talk about at the major league level. Without further ado, I bring on Tomorrow Media's Phil Maillard, who has been on here, film director extraordinaire. He's been on here before, a big, big Mets fan dating back, also a Brooklyn native of Crown Heights. Phil, welcome back to the Metsian podcast.
Gentlemen, Rich, Mike, what's up, partners?
Hey, Phil.
Hello. Good to speak with you again, sir.
Always.
So,
always,
Phil,
always,
we always
look forward to these.
Before we dive into it, we always like to go with shameless plug. Please tell the audience about yourself.
Well, I could say something good. I got up this morning, and that's always a good start to the day. Tomorrow Media is a company where we produce broadcast media or attempt to. Been working on a documentary about Calypso King of the world. His name is the Mighty Sparrow, who just turned 86 and performed last week Wednesday at Lincoln Center in the outdoor theater. It's amazing. He performed on August 4th, and Tony Bennett, who's 95, performed on August 3rd. So it's pretty incredible. In light, I've been shooting him for the last few years, and this is another opportunity to shoot him on Wednesday, which was a sold-out show outside and very pleasant environment, and he put on a good show. So amongst that and some other things we're developing, you know, trying to figure out the new world order as it stands.
NWO, as they say. Thank you, Phil. We appreciate it. Thank you for joining us tonight. And, you know, guys, there's a lot of blame to go around And, of course, I think it's kind of a nuanced discussion as to who is in, you know, the biggest blame. But I think just for prosperity's sake, I'd like to start the conversation with Sandy Alderson. And I'll go a little bit, you know, I've been talking about it for a few days now, and I haven't written it down, but I'll try my best to formulate everything that I've thought about with this. And I think that, you know, when you look at what the narrative was, let's just start from a thesis perspective with the narrative of the Yankees versus the Mets. And the Mets were chugging along through injuries while the Yankees just were completely energyless and most likely going to miss the playoffs. And with the way that the trade deadline intersected, you saw the two different veteran GMs who have basically at this point almost been around as long, you know, I think Sandy obviously got maybe like a 10-15 year jump start on Brian Cashman. But at this point, this is, you know, from a New York perspective, this is where the intersecting, comparing and contrasting, considering Sandy was brought back. And, you know, Mets kind of had a kind of, you know, you could probably say sputtered and went with necessity, considering Francisco Lindor was down, as well as the fact that they were really good friends in him and Javier Baez. So it came together only that way. And obviously the Trevor Williams part is incomplete. You got Rich Hill, and other than that, you know, they've lost some of these star, you know, these little bench mob stars that came, like Billy McKinney, are no longer on the team. So all of a sudden the energy, especially with Lindor out, say what you want about his offense, but he has been fantastic everywhere else. Lindor was no longer the leader on the infield. Lindor was no longer the leader on the field, and he had been hitting since June. Let's not even forget that. So all of a sudden, Rizzo and Gallo, you know, even though they didn't go after pitching, they still got what was lacking from their offense, which was energy. And they've mustered some wins, even though Rizzo went down with COVID, and they unfortunately, for Yankee fans, lost on Sunday. And meanwhile, the Mets have basically looked like historically awful, which you never thought you could – like, you always think, like, there's no way the Mets could look even more historically awful than the historically awful they already historically awfully were. And yet, here we are, and I wish I had the LOB numbers, but everybody that is listening to me, you guys know what those LOB numbers are over those last few games. And here is where I correlate those LOB numbers. And I correlate it with Sandy Alderson. And Sandy Alderson, at this point, I equate to Phil Jackson and the triangle and his money ball approach. It's completely falling apart. He had no energy at the trading deadline, and he has no energy with his approach of on-base percentage plus slugging. As we have seen, when the Mets get players on base, but there's no home runs, they leave them on at a ridiculous rate, especially with zero outs and the bases loaded, as we've seen recently. And so when Moneyball doesn't have the home run power, it doesn't work. And I think right now you are seeing Sandy Alderson's game being exposed. And I understand why he was brought back. He was brought back to be Steve Cohen's transition from an operational standpoint, because he needs somebody from who understood not only the players, because he brought some of these guys in, but also the organization as well as how to run an organization. But I think that especially if they miss the playoffs, and we can have a talk, like my issue is that if they do miraculously make it, they're going to still think this way works. And that's what, you know, the problem with the last one, and we can have that discussion. But what I see here is that Sandy Alderson's way is going the way of the triangle. It's 30 years old, and it's not working in this modern sense of baseball. And, you know, unless Lindor is the main energetic factor here, as we're going to get into, it's not. I believe the main issue is Sandy Alderson's way. Look back in 2018. Regardless of what you can say about Mickey Callaway, we all saw how the offense all of a sudden went from station to station to trying to take first to third, you know, stealing bases. They bled that in some fashion into 2019, and with some of these same players, they made a run that didn't work out, and then Mickey Callaway was let go. However, what's the difference between how exciting that 2019 team was and right now with some of the similar players? Sandy Alderson. So that's where I start. Phil, our featured guest, I start with you. Phil, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry about that. You use an analogy what Cashman's move was at the trading deadline. And all Cashman really did was get two home run hitters who could take advantage of the left field porch. I mean, the right field porch. So he basically has the same philosophy, home runs. We're waiting for home runs. I mean, that's what the Yankees are built on. The difference is that Rizzo and Gallo have injected something into this lineup that was brewing already. So I just want to address that point. As far as Sandy Alderson is concerned, if you look at the lineup that the Mets have, last year, even in the shortened season, 60 games, offensively this team was much better. We only replaced three starting positions in the starting lineup as far as batters are concerned, hitters, and that's James McCann, and we transferred Lindor. And that was, and you could say McNeil, but McNeil was already there. So that was it, really, the two positions in what our batting lineup was last year. The difference is the contact that those same last year are not doing this year. The difference in last year to this year is last year the starting pitching was not as good, and neither was the bullpen. This year, the starting pitching has been better. Even the pitchers that have come in have helped. For the most part, first part of the season. And for the most part, the bullpen has been better, except for a couple of meltdowns by Diaz and here and there, which is expected. But the difference is the players who made contact, who had extra base hits. I'm not talking about home runs. For instance, Dominic Smith, which was a doubles machine, only has 14 doubles this year. Leads the team in hits with 91. Dominic Smith is one of my favorite players, but 91 hits and only 14 are doubles, 11 home runs, no triples. So out of his 91 hits, 25 are for extra bases. And this team, when you're not having anybody else drive in runs or make contact, it's a problem. You have you brought in McCann. McCann has added something a little bit better offensively as far as making contact. Alonzo is Alonzo. McNeil was McNeil. The problem is these guys were also hurt. Brandon Nimmo, I thought, was one of the players that did come back off of the IL and contribute right away. Michael Conforto has been a disaster. So you look at that, and then you look at what propelled us to at least maintaining a first-place lead, which was the bench mob, as you called it. Like I said, Drury has been our best clutch hitter. Drury, McKinney, and I forgot the guy with the beard who actually did well every time the bases were loaded early in the season.
Mazika.
You guys can remember his
name. Mazika.
Right.
Patrick,
yeah.
Mazika.
Yeah, Mazika. I mean, those guys won games. And
I
then you brought up minor.
He looks like Conor McGregor.
Yeah, he does. And then you bring up a bunch of minor leaguers, which I never heard of, who actually contributed. So, yeah, it was a house of cards. Regular bat. These guys kept our heads above water, and we'll be able to take off. Well, it hasn't happened. And I don't know. It's not like these guys don't have a record of it happening, and I don't know how Sandy could take all the blame. And as far as what he could do during the trading deadline, those two players, let's say, for instance, he went after Rizzo and Gallo, those positions are already filled on our team. You have Alonzo and Conforto, who's in a contract year, We were trying to figure out whether we were going to sign him again. You know, so I think the uncertainty of what's going to happen in the free agent market and with their own players going into next year, there's probably something latent that Sandy's not trying to put all in right now. A little bit more pressure on the Yankees because they were slated to go to the World Series for the last 3 years. And so Cashman's working on different rules. But I'm not saying Sandy doesn't have any blame, but I don't think nearly the blame is what you've been placed on his staff.
Hey, you know, I understand where you're coming from the offense. They've been, like I said, historically awful, and you can't deny something's not right. This is the Metsian podcast, Tom Petty edition, Mets Free Fallen. Rich, you know, I have to say, there might be a lot of heartbreaker fans out there, but this, I don't think, is what Met fans had in mind. So for you, who is most to blame right now?
Well, you know, I want to do a couple of seconds on Sandy Alderson. You know, I've never been a fan. I've said that. I can't count the number of times I've said this on the podcast. So I don't like the philosophy. I'm not saying I'm not a fan of the man. I hope the man is doing very well. Nothing against him personally. But that philosophy, to me, you know, you're seeing exactly what's wrong with it. You know, Sandy has tried this philosophy. If I was doing the math a minute ago. I believe this is his 30th season as a general manager between the Mets, the Padres, and the Athletics, and he has won world championships. Now, I mean, people could say this, that, whatever. At times when he was in Oakland, he had the highest payroll in baseball, higher than the Yankees in the late 80s. So I don't want to hear the payroll stuff, okay? So when you've been a GM for 30 years and you've won once, you've achieved the pinnacle of the sport once, that's not good. I'm sorry. That is not good. You know, maybe you're a very smart guy, clearly is. You know, military veteran, Dartmouth grad, all that stuff. Okay, fine. And, you know, he has a lot to offer, absolutely. But we can't deify this guy because his approach, he's a numbers guy, he's an analytics guy. Well, I'll give you a number. One championship, 30 seasons. There's your number. Okay? All right. Now, why is that the case? Think, you know, Phil hit on it, you hit on it, Sam. Think about what's different, right? In the late 80s, you had the Bash Brothers, all that stuff. He had all that out in Oakland. Well, now you've got shifting in baseball. So now what these guys are doing is they're – and the shift is there to try to thwart the power hitter, right? Well, his philosophy that, you know, what you need is home runs and all that stuff, you know, one-dimensional offense, when they don't get under the ball, how many Mets hit it into the shift? They hit into the shift all the time. They don't go the other way. You know, it's an organizational philosophy that, to me, is flawed from the beginning. I think it's more flawed now. Because of the shifting, and you see it with the Mets. And when, like Phil was saying with Dom, when these guys don't hit for power, they're kind of useless because they're not contact hitters. They don't have a secondary approach. You know, they have no team speed to speak of. I mean, VR a little bit, I suppose, and Lindor when he's healthy, and Baez when he's healthy, which we should talk about that at some point. But, you know, they don't have an alternative approach, and they just keep – it's like – you keep pounding your head against the wall hoping something's going to change, and it doesn't. You know, if they catch fire and they start hitting for power, great. That'll be wonderful, and they'll start winning again. But they don't have an alternative approach, and that's what you're seeing. So secondly, you know, to talk about blame and stuff, yeah, of course it's on the players. I mean, you know, they're not getting it done. We do need to talk about Pete and his comments yesterday where he clearly thinks they are getting it done, and yes, he watches something that we're not watching. And then we should probably talk about Rojas at some point. You know, I don't know. You know, I don't want to put a lot of blame on him, but at the same time, when he's saying, and I want you guys to comment on this, please. When he's saying, we're not prepared to hit the fastball, we're getting beat by, you know, he didn't say this, but he's essentially saying average big league fastballs, and we're not prepared to hit it. Well, whose job is to prepare the team? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's the manager and the coaches, right? Isn't he indicting himself and his coaching staff when he says my team isn't prepared? That shocks me that he would come out and say stuff like that. You know, he's saying they're not prepared. Dude, That's your job. You're saying in front of millions of people, I am not doing my job. I don't have to indict him. He's indicting himself. So I don't know. It's kind of a hodgepodge answer, Sam, but that's where I am with all this stuff.
There's a lot of different places to go, Mike. We have, we've hit the 20-minute mark into the podcast. Which direction with everything we've talked about? The blame, specifics already. Where do you want to go with this?
Well, I'll start with you, Sam. Sandy Olgeson. You guys know I was not crazy about Steve Cohen's haste to bring him back into the fold. I'm a been there, done that kind of guy. And I made that perfectly clear back then. Now, the Mets are one game above 500. So that means there's almost an equal amount of good and bad to discuss. In Sandy Alderson's defense, there's been a lot of injuries. The Mets have set a record for players used on the roster. That, and I have to pick up where Phil left off and blame individual performances. In a large respect, some of these core players, put that in quotes, through 111 games have failed. There's not a 500 slugger on this team, speaking to doubles, triples, and home runs. Throughout the season, through 111 games, the numbers 3, 4, and 5 hitters together are only slugging 397. That's pitiful. And that's why we're second to last in runs scored, last in hits, last in total bases. Cycling back to Sandy Alderson, as Rich says or alludes to, there's something very eerily similar with this team's, successes to date. But there's also something very familiar about the way they fail. Old regime, new regime, Sandy Alderson is that common denominator now. So, I'm not necessarily in favor of keeping him beyond this season. I think Steve Cohen needs to do better in that respect and then rebuild this front office. My last word on this matter is I'm not going to flip out over the trade deadline and who we acquired, who we didn't acquire, and who we traded away to get said player. There's certain players in our minor league system that I'm just not in the mood to trade. We point to the Yankees, Brian Cashman, and that trade he pulled off, and depending on what MLB executive you speak of, not one of the prospects that the Yankees traded away were one of their top 10, no matter how much lipstick they want to put on them. So it is what it is, but the Mets are in a bad way. I go back to the Pittsburgh games. They're 11-17 since those games. And as we know, they went from first place to third place. Philly's been under 500 throughout the season. Now they suddenly turned it around. We always thought the National League East was going to flip. We just didn't know how much. And right now, we're in the midst of that. So let's see where we go.
I will say another thing. I contrast with the Yankees from a trading deadline perspective because they are within our city. But I will go to what the Phillies did. And say what you want about Kyle Wilson. Did I get the name right? Anybody? Kyle Wilson, right?
The pitcher they picked up?
Yeah.
They picked up Ian Kennedy, and they picked up the starter from Texas. His name
anybody?
Is escaping me too.
Kyle Gibson, not Wilson. Not Wilson, but Gibson. So a guitar as opposed to a volleyball. Great. All right. I'm glad we're there. However, Kyle Gibson, Ian Kennedy, even let's toss in, even though he's injured, Freddie Galvis. They obviously seem to be pitching better, Phil. They seem to be having more energy, especially than the Mets, and they seem to also have had a more energetic trading deadline, even though they weren't in first at the time. They were trying to overcome us. And right now, as of, you know, a few days ago, they have.
Well, in response to that, I don't think pitching has been our major problem, except for Taiwan has been doing brain farts up there since the All-Star break. Pitching, not the problem, has been hitting, and it's a term I quoted, a metdemic, a lack of offensive production, a metdemic of getting extra base hits. Period. Now I'm not talking about home runs, like Pete Alonso wants you to believe that he's the best power hitter in the game. It's not about that. It's making contacts and moving the line along. And you do that by getting doubles. You get doubles, you get singles, you move the line. We haven't done it all season. So the reason why we're in trouble is because the rest of the National League East decided to wake up for a change. All their cylinders are firing at the same time. And what we anticipated was our starters will come back. After the All-Star break, we'll get a rest. Our starters will come back. Our regulars will come back, and they're going to do what they normally did. And like I said, the big black hole in this offense is our right fielder. Actually, our outfield, period, has been a big black hole in this offense. Dominic Smith has made more contact than anybody else, but still not really the same influencing year that we saw for Dominic last year or even the year before last. So who is that person that is doing that? You know, Lindor was picking it up, but he still hadn't had any continuity. And I think that's a word we just don't have. What's the continuity? DeGrom was the only thing that was continuous with this team all year. Can't win without some kind of continuity. And so I think that's where it is. I understand what you're saying as far as the trade deadline is concerned. But listen, that's a shot in the dark anyway. You're trading for players that the other team needed to get rid of either for salary cap reasons or they're just cleaning house, and you hope that's a fit to whatever team that you're trading to. So I can't speak for what the Phillies did and how those players are responding.
Well, I agree with you. Like, it's all kind of a crapshoot, the trading deadline and the playoffs. I think what you talked about DeGrom, I think that is a direction we're going to go, but I don't want to go off on that direction yet. What I want to stick a little bit with the Phillies right now, and Rich, I guess I'll say this. Saturday night, I could have predicted what happened, and every time that we hit another home run, I kept tweeting, I can hear Frank Fleming now. Every single one. I sent it out like three different times. I can hear Frank Fleming now. I can hear Frank Fleming now. We don't have the lead. We still don't have the lead. We still don't have the lead. You can predict that, and you can predict what happened with Zach Wheeler on Sunday. I mean, it was as predictable as, a Disney movie that went straight to streaming.
Good analogy. So, Saturday night, you know, the Phillies had the bullpen, right? So I was thinking Mets were going to win that game. And, you know, we should maybe think for a minute that the Mets caught a lot of crap or, you know, I don't know who makes the lineup. Obviously, it's not Rojas, whoever makes the lineup. Caught a lot of crap for the lineup they put out there. But I actually thought it was a good idea. They knew that the Phillies were doing a bullpen game. They were starting a lefty. Ranger Suarez. And so the Mets stacked the lineup with righties, even though some of these guys aren't their quote-unquote best players, knowing that the Phillies would get this guy out in the third inning, then they would switch over to a left-handed hitting lineup, which to me made a lot of sense. You know, you have their bullpen. Yes, they've got Alvarado as a lefty, but you've got Neris and Kennedy as right-handers. So it made sense. I thought it was a very logical approach when you know your opponent is doing a bullpen game, but it didn't work. I mean, they couldn't hit Ranger Suarez. They couldn't hit the other guys, the parade of relievers they brought in. And it was kind of like, my God, you know, when a team does a bullpen game, I'm not suggesting that they're, you know, that they're punting the game, but clearly it's a game that even the team itself, you know, probably thinks, all right, well, if we win it, good for us, but, you know, this is where we are. We're short on pitching. It's not our first choice to do this. And the Mets couldn't touch these guys. You know, yeah, they had the comeback late, but, I mean, did you not see that coming? I knew they would find a way to have at least a tying run at that, and they did. And then once they lost the first two games, you know, when Rojas on Saturday night was saying, well, you know, very important game, you know, we need to win tomorrow, we need to win tomorrow, I thought that was ill-advised on his part because they were going up against a guy who might win the National League Cy Young, a guy who has a chip on his shoulder, which he said as much, he used those exact words yesterday. He has a chip on his shoulder about the Mets. And I thought those were ill-timed comments. I mean, you could say, look, you know, we need to come in here, we need to keep grinding, face a tough opponent tomorrow. You know, when he's saying we need to win, that was a little too much for me against Wheeler. And I saw it coming. I saw Wheeler basically anesthetizing that team, which is exactly what he did. And, you know, the team is in a horrible way offensively, facing a guy who's got a chip on his shoulder who, like I said, probably will win the Cy Young. And you could kind of see the way the cards are stacked. But to your point, Sam, the game that surprised me was Saturday because I really thought, silly me, that against the bullpen game against the Phillies, that would be the game they would win, and they didn't.
So, Mike, Zach Wheeler, does it sting for the fact that, you know, it was only by a couple of years that Steve Cohen obviously would have signed Zach Wheeler, and there wouldn't be this, oh, God, especially with the words of Brody Van Wagenen afterwards, you know, just like this ugly chip on his shoulder about the New York Mets organization. So on top of that, Zach Wheeler is most likely going to win the Cy Young when the person who would and should have won the Cy Young on your team is going to be down for the year with an 0.95 ERA. Stuck for all eternity, most likely. I mean, I know he's supposed to be coming back in September, so let me not go into it. But, again, we can go off on the Jacob deGrom tangent right after that, but the irony, it does in many ways remind me of the 2009 collapse that happened slightly earlier, except at the end we got eliminated by Pedro Martinez in a 1-0 game against the Phillies.
You know what? I look at Tawan Walker, and yeah, his second half has been a little disturbing. You might call this last outing better. But you look at him, and I look at Zach Wheeler, and then I look back at Walker, and then I look back at Zach Wheeler, and I can only shake my head. Whoever the GM was, this organization did not treat Zach Wheeler well. And the last thing I said was, you know, Zach Wheeler's better days are ahead. I meant that then, and, you know, we're seeing that transpire now. I wish he was a Met. He was one that I really wanted, you know, to keep him in the fold, but it wasn't to be. And you know, he's playing in Philly, and I tell you, outside of Coors Field, that's got to be the country's second largest pinball machine. There's no reason why that park should be that small. Going back to Saturday's game, 6 home runs. Come on. Five of them went to right field. I don't think that's a coincidence. But Zach Wheeler, you know, I'm forever gonna, you know, throughout his career at least, I'm gonna regret that one on behalf of the Mets. That was a bad move. They should have re-signed him. But what they brought back, you know, to replace him, come on, and look where they are now.
I'll go to you next, Rich. We talked about Louis Rojas and Marcus Stroman and not swinging the bat because you were afraid of grounding into a double play, but then Brandon Nimmo grounded into a double play with one out. So where are you and let's just have the Louis Rojas conversation now, that at this particular point, with the craziest stretch of the year coming up after they have been ousted from first place currently, where are you on Louis Rojas? And let's also, you know, go both micro and macro with that particular move.
Okay. So micro on that move. You know, I think I was telling you before we went on air, I was out, you know, watching it in the restaurant, and I think a lot of Met fans probably said, oh, please hit him to double play, right? Because pitcher up, bases loaded, no outs. So that's one thing, you know, to hope that he's not hitting into a double play. But to get an order from the dugout not to swing, listen to Todd Zeal. Listen to this guy who's been around Major League Baseball a lot, you know, who clearly knows what he's talking about. And he said, you know, it seemed like that was managing not to lose. Like, it's almost like you're managing scared at that point. You're worrying about the boogeyman behind the corner, you know, the bad thing that might happen. It was early in the game. I believe it was the top of the fourth. Let him have. He runs really well. Stroman's, you know, runs quite well. And if he hits the ball on the ground, maybe he beats it out. And if he doesn't, you know what? It's not the top of the ninth. It's not the end of the game. The game was already tied. So why are we managing not to lose early game like that? It sends kind of a bad message to Stroman, who was clearly irritated by it. But to the team as well. I mean, the team, imagine what those guys are thinking. Zeal, like I just said, former player, thinking it's managing not to lose, like you're afraid to lose. And that has to send a message to the team. It's not a good one. And Rojas in general, you know, I think he's a mixed bag this year. He did very well keeping them together when they had the replacements and, you know, keeping them afloat and actually keeping them in first place, which is fantastic. He did a great job at that point. But, you know, the true test of the manager comes when things are going badly. Yes, those were injuries going badly. And the players that were brought in, he kept them together and they won. That's great. Well, now there are some serious waves on the water. And let's see how he does. And I would say right now, you know, I don't know. You know, I go back, Sam, I keep going back to him saying, and he said it a couple times, a couple different days, we're not prepared to hit the fastball. Whose responsibility is to prepare the team? That's why you pay coaches. That's why you pay a manager. You could argue all you want. The manager doesn't suit up. Manager doesn't hit, doesn't field, doesn't pitch. Okay, great. Absolutely true. What do? They prepare. If he is saying these guys, he's not saying they didn't look prepared. He's saying they are not prepared. Again, gentlemen, please comment, because I'm just one guy with an opinion. How is he not indicting himself when he says something like that? And that gives me pause about him. I have to think it's giving Steve Cohen pause about him, because if you're a leader of people and you're saying, I'm not doing my job because I'm not preparing you folks, to me, if I'm the owner, if I'm the big boss, I'm literally freaking out when I hear that. So, guys, what do you think?
Phil, you and I did go back and forth about that entire thing, and you said I was kind of overblowing it in some fashion. And obviously, I think both you and I typed, you know, a pretty solid response back and forth to each. So what say you on air?
Well, a couple of things. You know, what we have to understand is that a lot of times what managers, coaches, and those who have press conferences after every game say in the media is not necessarily what the message is given to the team or the clubhouse. We have to understand that, because sometimes as fans, we expect that those press conferences are a little window into what they're thinking and what they're explaining to their players. And that's not necessarily true. So what I took when he said we're not prepared to hit the fastball, I took that as a sense of bewilderment on his part. Like, I can't believe we're not prepared to hit the fastball, because that's what we were doing. We did that all of last year. That's what you players are doing. And just a case in point, and of course, statistics are very funny because they can be altered to make whatever point you want. But I just want to read a stat to you guys that I think is fascinating. It's called extra base hit percentage. The top three or four players on the Mets in that are Travis Blankenhorn, Brandon Drury, Jonathan Fargis, and last but not least, Billy McKinney. They were all 11% or higher. And even though there's a small window of plate appearances, the point is when they got to the plate, usually they were pinch hitting with runners on base something. What do? They deliver. And that has been the problem. Those guys are not even on the team. Half of them, only Drury is left. So if you want to say, were those guys prepared to hit the fastball when it came? Because when you're coming off the bench, what are you getting? Fastballs. So I don't think it's so much that he's saying, I didn't do a good job. I think he's sitting there saying, he can't tell you, hey, guys, I can't figure it out. He's not going to say that. You know, and certain managers aren't great with the media. So I don't really take that with a grain of salt and what's kind of expressed compared to what you might actually think is done. As far as I didn't have a disagreement or a different point of view from you, from Sam, about his decision. What I thought was they were preventing Met pitchers from swinging the bats since the Pittsburgh series, because three of his starting pitchers hurt themselves swinging the bats. So if you notice a pattern, very little are they letting pitchers swing the bat. So I thought he was factoring that in. But what I disagreed with was the comment which you took from Twitter of a losing mentality. And that's my problem. It's not so much you disagree with the decision, but to say the guy has a losing mentality is really over the top as far as indicting or making a judgment on a particular manager, giving him the circumstances, what he's dealing with, and the fact that the people that are in charge or entrusted to deliver or not. That was my issue was, but that's on Twitter. And so I don't take things that are said on Twitter very seriously, but that was my issue.
So, Mike, you know, a lot of things are said on Twitter. One of them being that specific move regarding Marcus Stroman not swinging the bat was a loser mentality. So, with everything that we've come around, so many different opinions going so many different ways, where do you stand on both that move as well as Louis Rojas macro?
I don't have an issue with Luis Rojas per se. I have more of an issue, as we started this show, with the president and the front office. You know, to me, the crap rolls downhill. But not swinging, not being prepared to hit a fastball, that's not baseball. That's the only way I can explain it. That's not baseball. And I'm in complete lockstep with Phil. Sometimes managers are put in a position and they're just stupefied having to explain away some analytical backfire, some ridiculousness like not being prepared to hit a fastball. Maybe they're going into the box with too much information in their heads, you know? Look, baseball is doing a lot of things that throughout our lifetimes people told us not to do. You want batters going into the box with an empty mind, okay? We were told have a level swing, and now they're being taught to uppercut, launch angle. It's the world has flipped. The world has flipped, you know. So I don't know what's going on, but I agree with Phil insofar as managers being just unprepared to explain away some of this, you know, analytical maelstrom that they've created.
So I'll loop back around to you, Rich. Having heard the two just being, you know, talking about being stupefied, what say you?
Well, I mean, if it's semantics, then fine. If that's not what he meant, then I retract my comments. However, what I heard, and I could be, you know, I could be wrong, could be just the way he was answering the question. Maybe it's not what he meant. But I'll give me an example, okay? So in the pregame meetings that they have, pre-series and pregame, coaches, I am sure, are sitting down saying, okay, look, when the Phillies bullpen comes in, this Alvarado guy throws 100 miles an hour, and, you know, he's a little wild, you know, whatever they're saying. Maybe take a pitch, whatever, guy's wild, okay, great. Ian Kennedy is a one-trick pony. You know, he spots his fastball well. He's going to throw his fastball 70-80% of the time. It's not an overpowering fastball. It's 93 to 95, 93 to 96, something like that. That's who Ian Kennedy is. So when he comes in, and then you're saying, so I'm sure they did that. I think we would all agree that that meeting took place and they're discussing these things, analytics, right? Okay. How then is Pete? How is JD? How are they not prepared to hit that pitch if they were told? Unless they weren't, this is who Ian Kennedy is. This is who Alvarado is, who didn't pitch in that game, or I think he pitched in the middle innings. This is who Ian Kennedy is. And you're saying, well, my two best hitters struck out. We weren't prepared to hit the fastball. What? Did you not tell them that's who this guy is? I mean, it blows my mind. Unless he was implying something else. Unless, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he was implying that, I don't know what he was implying. I mean, maybe I'm too literal of a person, but to me, it's like, if this is who Ian Kennedy's not a rookie, he came up in 2007. If the book on this guy, to use an old term, if the book on this guy is that's what he does, how are you not prepared to hit him? Unless his words meant something else. And like someone said earlier, you know, in a press conference, it's tough with glaring lights, or, you know, this case, the glaring Zoom. And maybe he wasn't trying to say something else, and this is what came out. But the exact words did not flatter him or his coaching staff.
If I may, this is why I think it's somewhat above Luis Urias, because the Mets fired Chili Davis, and then we were told it's not the results, it's the process. Well, look where the process has gotten us, you know. So to hear that is ponderous. So, you know, this narrative is being directed from, I guess, behind closed doors. You know, people in the analytics room will never have to answer to the media. It's up to Luis Rojas. And that's why sometimes I think these guys are stupefied having to come up with some kind of explanation over what went on.
I want to add into that. I think that's exactly right. I think the two relievers that we face, we've had success with those guys in the past. If you look at our stats when they come in the game, I think we've taken them both to the woodshed at times. And you have your three best fastball hitters, quote unquote, coming up. There's no way that they didn't know that. I think, again, what Rojas is not going to say, you know, guys, we worked on hitting the fastball all year and these guys didn't do it. He's not going to do that. He's not going to throw his players under the bus like that on a press conference. He's going to go the other way, and he's not going to say, I'm totally stupefied and bewildered why my best hitters can't hit a fastball. They know it's coming. He's not going to say that. So if you're expecting him to say that, and you're waiting for him in the press conference to say that, guess what? Sorry, he's not going to do that. He looks at himself as a player's manager. He's not that far in age from them, so he's going to take the hit. And what he said was, we weren't prepared. Not that I didn't do my job. Not that the guys don't know what's coming. Not that there's not a scouting report. Pete Alonso hit 53 home runs. I bet at least 25 of them on fastballs. He knows when the fastball is coming. He's not stupid. J.D. Davis, 90% of his home runs are on fastballs. He knows it's coming. So by trying to say that what he said inferred that that's the job he's doing, I'm trying to get you all to understand there's two separate things. What is said in front of the media is not necessarily what is said in the clubhouse to the players. It's almost like sports talk radio. You get some guys that get on sports talk radio, they make a comment because they want the board to light up. I want you to disagree or agree with me. It's the same thing. So people use it as clickbait to galvanize their own thoughts in the direction they want to go. I didn't take it like that because those are major league players. If you can't hit a fastball, you're not in the major leagues. So it's just the bottom line. If you can't do that, you can't be in the major leagues. So
there's so many different places that I wanted to go, and so, like, I'm just going to have to literally spin the wheel in my head and go with the J.D. Davis part. This is where people are talking about whether or not the Mets traded for the right cup And I'll start with you, Rich, on that. Again, I was talking about, you know, trading for necessity, Javier Baez being there, all the comments about Francisco Lindor and whatnot. It seemed to actually make sense. However, when you consider him and his offense, his Dave Kingman-esque offense being inserted into the lineup, as much as you can see his championship pedigree, you have to wonder whether that is factoring into everything right now. So where are you right now on not only Javier Baez, but considering, again, like where the offense is, and considering how everybody who is failing currently, like J.D. Davis at third, where they fit into that failure, and you see the Cubs saying, where are you on it?
Well, I'd like to know timelines on this stuff, because now we're hearing J.D. Davis has had a setback with the hand. He's going to have to deal with the rest of the season, and that's exactly as Met fans what we don't want to hear, because it conjures up the ghosts of Christmas past. You know what I mean? All these guys who tried to play through injuries at various times, weren't themselves. Then, you know, it comes out later, maybe years later, they were forced to play and all that kind of stuff. I don't mean he's not being forced, but now you have a guy who they say is going to play compromised. We can all agree that that's the case. He's playing compromised in some way. Why do you want that? I mean, so what I want to know is, if they knew that this guy, that he had the relapse in the hand before the trading deadline, and they opted for Baez over Bryant, then I think it is a mistake. I think, you know, third base right now, yuck. I mean, that's all I could say. You know, JD is awful. I mean, he's nothing short of awful right now. And probably because he's hurt. That's probably why. But okay, but he's still bad. And so if they knew about it prior, and if they knew about DeGrom prior, which is very weird that the DeGrom thing came out just a couple hours, you know, right after the trading deadline, if they knew about DeGrom, should they have gone, you know, more heavily after a starting pitcher, all these things. We don't know that, at least I don't, you know, I don't think anyone does. What knowledge did they have before the trading deadline? And that to me would say whether or not they acted appropriately or inappropriately. Now, about Baez, it's a hell of an athlete. And I think if you're going to spend prospect capital like Pete Crow Armstrong, number one draft pick, you know, you hear the rumblings Baez might be interested in sticking around because he didn't say those exact words. He did say he'd like to play near Lindor. So if you're going to spend a prospect capital, maybe it's smarter to spend it on somebody who might stick around. So maybe on the other side, when Lindor comes back and, you know, God willing, it'll be by the end of the month, he is doing light baseball activities, maybe Baez goes to third, you know, McNeil stays second, and now, okay, so now we get J.D. Davis off the field, and now we've got an infield that at least everybody's healthy. Well, McNeil's not, but that's a different story. So this whole thing could work out, but to answer your original question, Sam, I would love to know, and I don't think I ever will, what knowledge did they have going into the trading deadline? And that to me would need that information to answer your question, you know, accurately, in my opinion, about whether or not they acted appropriately. I just want to know what they knew and didn't know. And I'd like to know about pitching as well as J.D. Davis.
Pitching's really interesting. And Mike, I'll spin the wheel to you. And talk also again about like Ian Kennedy that Rich was bringing up about specifically what Ian Kennedy does and the Mets not being able to handle it. That's still an asset that has gotten it done for the Phillies coming in. And say what you want about Edwin Diaz, and I want to start the Edwin Diaz conversation here. The Mets, you know, even the pitching with Trevor Williams, who is kind of a spot starter anyway, the Mets could have gone the Craig Kimbrel role, but they did not. Obviously, he only went cross town. But, you know, when you look at it, Edwin Diaz right now, not only I think as Met fans, can you not necessarily have confidence that if the Mets were to make it, that he'd be able to persevere? There's too much you got to believe there, if you will. That the Mets should have done a little bit more to bolster, if not completely a different closer, to at least bolster something, you know, behind him that can obviously, you know, be inserted if Edwin Diaz can't do it. So, Mike, where are you on that? You know, is it, again, just going to, there's a lot of pieces that you wouldn't give up in the farm system? Is that where you still fall into what happened at the trade deadline?
Well, we don't know all the conversations that took place. We don't know what players were investigated, inquired about. We don't know that. Could they have done more? We like to think so, especially now that we have an owner with deep pockets with discretionary income, you know, so to say. But at the same time, you know, we still have to be pragmatic about this. The Mets have gone through 35 pitchers this season. 35. So what were we going to do? Break the bank for 36 and 37? So it depends what names were in the equation. I understand you mentioned the closer. He went cross town to the White Sox. They're going for it. You know, who knows what the Cubs were seeking? It takes two to reach an agreement. Maybe what the Mets were offering wasn't to their satisfaction or liking. We just don't know. You know, I'm not too disgruntled with the trade deadline. Because I just don't think the Mets are there that good compared to the competition. Yes, we were in first place, but, you know, we had maybe the fifth or sixth most wins in the National League. You know, so we weren't preeminent entities of the National League, so to say. We were just hanging in there with the faltering division. Third base is a non-issue to me. Yeah, J.D. Davis is terrible. We get that. But I want that position cleared out just the same way the Mets cleared out shortstop and handed it to Ahmed Rosario with no detours, potholes, speed bumps, detour signs, or anything. They just opened up the position and gave it to Ahmed. That's what I want the Mets to do at third base with either Vientos or Beatty when the time comes. I don't want the position bogged down with, you know, veteran trash that nobody wants. So really, third base is not an issue to me. The real issue to me, circling back to, you know, the greater conversation this evening and with what Phil was, you know, hammering home this evening, and I'm in lockstep with him, to me it's the core players. Yeah, we've had a lot of injuries, but Dom Smith, Pete Alonso, and Lindor were together for at least 80 games. Dom Smith and Pete Alonso have been together throughout the season. You know, and then you throw in your McCann, and then when Mike Conforto was available, and when McNeil was available. The core players on this team are not performing. So who's to say we would have imported somebody like a Rizzo, etc.? Yeah, he might have sparked something, perhaps. But what about these core players? What was going to happen with their performances? What's going to happen with their performances? Are they going to all of a sudden awaken with three weeks left in the season, late September? And leave us hanging through another offseason saying, oh, but they got hot. They're going to be good. We should have. So at some point, we need to make definitive decisions. And that's why I'll circle back to they need to assess what kind of team this is. And I don't think we're on par with the Dodgers or the Giants or some of the more prominent teams in baseball. We're good. And with DeGrom, we're better. But we need to do more on the farm level and at the major league level. And that's where I stand.
Oh, you know, So many places to go, and with us rounding out almost to an hour, I will reset with your listening to the Metsian podcast. And Phil, Edwin Diaz, third base. And let me just throw out there, like, Anthony Rizzo, I wasn't saying specifically Anthony Rizzo or anything like that, obviously.
I get you.
I don't think Anthony Rizzo was ever a fit for trading for him. However, whether it be Edwin Diaz or the prospects that he talks about, let's split the question into that where I lead for you, Phil. Let's talk about Edwin Diaz as well as third base. I will also go on the record as saying I agree with him specifically when it comes to third base. I would have been trading for Chris Bryant only as a rental.
Right.
I think those two players right now are it's clear that the front office has cleared the way for that eventually. And regardless of what's going on with J.D. Davis.
Right. Well, Edwin Diaz is funny because that's going to be one of those marks in Mets history that we will look back at depending on what happens in the next 3 to 4 years with the prospects we sent over and what Edwin Diaz eventually accomplishes with this team or what this team, I should say, what this team accomplishes with Edwin Diaz as the closer, not so much the opposite way. If this team goes to the playoffs and eventually gets to the World Series and Edwin Diaz is on it and he gets a crucial save here and there along the way, everybody will love him. Until then, we're going to point at these potential prospects that we sent over to Seattle for him. And let's talk about that for a second because neither one of those guys are doing much for Seattle farm system as far as I know. Kalinic came up early in spring training, hit well, then was sent down after going 0 for 20-something. I don't know what his numbers are in my league, but that's to say.
Phil, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but he got a home run at Yankee Stadium the other day, crazy enough.
Okay. But that's just to say that, we don't know, we can't assume that those players are going to be great. And I hope for his sake he does well. So on Edwin Diaz, Edwin is here. A couple years ago, you couldn't give Kimbrel away, with a box seat at a stadium. He was horrible. But now all of a sudden he's had a good year. So now he's, the White Sox are going to trade for them. And relievers are, man, it's like the weather in Mexico. It changes every 15 minutes. So not really sure as far as that's concerned. Third base. I thought they should have went after Chris Bryant for a couple of reasons. One, because I think he has the right attitude on a team we need. And two, also because he can play the outfield. And I thought with the Mets, their players not doing well, it gives Rojas a couple other options to go in the middle of the game, the seventh, eighth inning. If he wanted to go in for defense, he could move Bryant to the outfield. I mean, I thought it gave them a little bit more dexterity in what you can get for the lineup. And I just thought that I listened to what Chris Bryant was talking about being mic'd up at the All-Star game. And granted, it's an All-Star game, but it was something about the way he was conveying what he was doing, what he was thinking. He's out in the field that kind of made me think, hey, this is a good guy to have in the clubhouse. Not saying Baez isn't, but Baez just got finished a week before he came to Mets yelling and screaming at a pitcher and didn't even make it to first base almost before he got tagged out. I don't need another hothead on the team. And that's what it is. He almost got into a fight not the other day after popping out. So I'm not making an indictment on him as a human being. I'm just saying what this team needs right now for the rest of the season, I thought Chris Bryant would have filled the bill. And also he's a contact hitter. So I thought that was a mistake on their part and in the person they chose. But again, like was mentioned, we don't know what Chicago Cubs were asking for Chris Bryant. And I think the front office, Zach and Sandy, will kind of ride the fence because this offseason coming up actually is the most important one that they'll have. With Syndergaard and Conforto, they have to be signed. you know, they have a very short window with DeGrom, which they're very acute to. What moves are they going to make? And I think you're going to see massive changes, even if that includes the manager, in this offseason. So I just don't think they want to make that in season. I think they want to wait till offseason.
I agree. And that's a lot of things we can discuss in the last half hour. Before I want to go around and just discuss whatever else you guys want to discuss in the last half hour, but I'm going to start for this last half hour with my opinion as to what Steve Cohen should do. And I would say, regardless of whether or not the Mets make the playoffs, and I think if the Mets won the World Series this year, we could say that it's one of those miracle years. And what I would hope wouldn't happen is that everything they have been doing be seen, if a miracle occurs, as the way to go, because that's, again, exactly the cycle of hubris that we've been accustomed to with this franchise. So I still think that Steve Cohen, you know, Theo Epstein took a job at MLB, and he's trying to basically, like, bring MLB a little bit more into the future. However, I think Steve Cohen needs to do an all-out blitz on Theo Epstein to make him president of baseball operations. And wherever we go from there with the front office is a different discussion. Where Zach Scott or Sandy Alderson or whatever fits into it. Sandy Alderson, at this point, I think that he probably needs to sail off into the sunset. I think Steve Cohen needs to do an all-out blitz on Theo Epstein in selling the point of the trifecta of cursed franchises and rounding it all out. Rich, what say you?
Cohen should do over the offseason?
Yes, and whether he should go after Theo Epstein.
Well, sure. I mean, in my opinion, absolutely. I think make Sandy an advisor, you know, man deserves dignity and all that stuff. Absolutely. But Theo Epstein, you know, the guy's a winner. He's won in Boston. He's won in Chicago. Both of those franchises, you know, needed it. They and, you know, both storied franchises, and he brought winners there. A guy who's won in the current era, you know, I mean, come on. If the guy would take the job, why wouldn't you? You know, he's won in big markets. He's won in recent memory. He's savvy to the way the game is played today. Oh, my God, I'd love to see that. Do I think it'll happen? No. No, I don't. You know, I think Sandy's going to be there, I'm going to say 3 to 5 more years in the role he's in. Zach Scott, we'll figure it out. We don't really, I mean, does anybody really believe Zach Scott is making the moves? I don't. Maybe he is, but I don't believe it for a minute. I think Sandy Alderson is doing everything. Maybe, maybe not. You know, we'll see if the interim tag is removed and he's given the full-time GM job, or maybe they go another direction. But I don't see the Mets. While I would love to see them bring in Theo Epstein and give Sandy a ceremonial position, I don't see that happening. I think most people will point to, oh, it's been only 1 year. You know, he brought in Sandy Alderson to be the moderating force or whatever you want to call it. And it's too early to make the move. So I don't think Alderson's going anywhere. No, but I would love to see it.
Mike, what say you?
What say me? You know, Scuttlebutt says that Theo Epstein, you know, he already won with the Cubs. He already won with the White Sox. He's already been there, done that, that he's looking towards bigger and better things. He's looking to save baseball, not just one organization. But that's rumor. Who knows if he'll actually come back down to this level and do it all over again. It'd be nice. He's certainly the right guy for it. But again, I'll cycle back to Steve Cohen's haste to bring Sandy Alderson back into the organization when he did. At that moment in time, by becoming the owner of the New York Mets, he made the office of president of the New York Mets front office, the most sought after, one of the most prestigious offices in baseball, just by his mere arrival on the scene. And he went right to Sandy Alderson, and that perturbed again, because I'm a forward-moving person, been there, done that. And now we're starting to see, both good and bad, some of the familiarities that we've had from one regime to the other. So, you know, I really need, or would really like for Mr. Cohen to rethink his front office, especially his, you know, president of baseball operations. Keep Sandy Alderson on as an advisor. Give him a role. Let him stay around. You know, he's an intelligent person. But I need something different, because I can easily say that because Sandy Alderson is still around, I can attack this situation the same way I did the Wilpons, by having an inbred organization, by refusing to go off campus and bring in new, unassociated, unfamiliar thinking into the fold. And that's not what Sandy Alderson is. He is not a stranger to this organization. He is too familiar to this organization. And perhaps what Steve Cohen needs to do is bring in somebody who has no previous relationship or association with the Mets and start taking this thing into a radically new direction.
Phil, what say you?
I am in agreement. You know, my defense of this particular year and what Sandy Alderson has to do with it is not an indictment of what I felt about him coming back to this team. I agree. I think they should have totally brought in fresh blood, fresh perspective. But while he's here, I was still trying to make the best of the situation as far as my opinion of what he does. But I concur. I think Steve Cohen, because of the lateness of the sale, when it went through, had to rely on something and somebody. And he had a relationship with Sandy because Steve was a 5% owner of the Mets, I'm sure, had developed a relationship with Sandy. So in order to get him up and running to that position, and he felt he had somebody he could bounce stuff off of, somebody who wouldn't be intimidated by him. So I get it. What we as fans are tired of, though, is, you know, we've heard all these stories before. We just want results. We want them now. And understanding that this is a major, major financial investment for Mr. Cohen, and he's not going to be just kind of, you know, willy-nilly about it. So that's why I brought in Sandy. I think Sandy will always have a position with this team in the front office, depending on what roles that play. And as we're talking about Theo Epstein, listen, I'll all for Theo Epstein. But I think cleaning house, and you can look at my horrible New York Knicks to see what the result of cleaning house was, except for Scott Perry, who survived three regimes. They are now on the upswing. That team now has a process and a thought process and a way of going about their business, which you have to feel confident in that somewhere down the way it'll lead to fruition. Baseball's a little different. It's old money. It's not new money. And the way these guys operate is still kind of archaic. But I do agree that I think after this season, and again, this offseason is going to be crucial for the Mets. A lot of decisions have to be made. I don't think they're necessarily going to bring either Syndergaard or Conforto back, maybe one, maybe not either. I think that's where all this upheaval and change we're going to see is in the winter months before next February.
Phil, I appreciate, you know, as I was kind of concocting where I was going to go with this next, you brought up how the thought process is still kind of archaic, and you brought up old money versus new money. So I guess I'll frame my question in that here I am bringing up Theo Epstein, bringing in, you know, a veteran already brought, going to be a Hall of Famer one way or another if the Mets don't bring him in. But yet again, let's look at the fact that the front office and baseball in general has been very white. And I am talking about bringing in another front office man that would be of the Caucasian variety. So where are you on that as we talk about getting Sandy Alderson, a 30-year veteran who is also white, when, you know, many – we just got the first woman in general manager down in Marlins. Is that something you would like to see the Mets go in that direction? Is that where you would like to see Steve Cohen go next instead of somebody like Theo Epstein? Even though you disagreed that, like, you wouldn't mind him.
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, what I mean, old money and the complexion of the people, those are two kind of parallel tracks a little bit. So as a Mets fan, I could really care less who is up there as long as my team wins. So if you're going to tell me we can get an Asian female, and let's also mention that she's of Asian persuasion, which is one of the first in Major League Baseball. If you're going to tell me that's going to make my team win, I'm all for it. If you tell me it's an old 80-year-old white guy who's been sitting on his lawn, I'm all for it. I could care less as a Mets fan. So I want to get that straight. But, yeah, listen, the complexity, and this is the reason why I'm kind of in favor of Mr. Rojas running my team right now and being in the dugout. This guy worked his way up through the minor leagues. He played ball. He was never that good enough to make it to major league, but he intimately understands the players that are coming into his dugout. He has worked with them in not only minor leagues, but in Puerto Rico, you know, Puerto Rican leagues. He understands the process. I think we just got to let him get his footing. His first year, he had COVID. You know, he had the Wilpons. He had a whole lot of stuff going on. This year, he's had a massive injuries as was caught. 57 players were used by this team before the month of August. 15 starting pitchers was the most pitchers ever used before the month of August since 1910. And we're asking him to do all that stuff, and we're running results at the same time. But and then we're going to nitpick what he says at press conferences. I think, you know, baseball is not an immediate thing. It's not instant gratification like football or basketball, where you throw the ball, goes to the basket, you kick the ball, it's a field goal or something. It's not. It works a little differently. So I think the process has to happen. I hate using that word because you always hear that so much in terms of that. But I do think that you could change the tone and the texture of the people in there, but that doesn't mean anything to me. It's the results, and so that's where I'm at as a Mets fan.
I love hearing that, Phil. Thank you. And going around the horn, Rich. You know, this is I wanted to start by talking about where you guys wanted to go in the last half hour. So everything that's been said, if you want to piggyback on what Phil just was talking about, go ahead wherever you want to go.
Well, you know, when it comes to diversity in baseball, of course, more is needed. There's no question. And, you know, that's an indisputable fact. Then having said that, my incredible selfishness as a fan then kicks in. And, you know, if you told me that we're going to put an African-American person, an Asian woman, somebody of Indian descent who, you know, doesn't identify sexually, I don't give a shit. I don't. I want this team to win a World Series before I freaking die. I don't care who that general manager is. And if it could be, I was a huge fan of Kim Ng, huge fan of Kim Ng, and I wish she would have been GM. When you look at what she's done and where she's been in baseball, I was really hoping the Mets would have had the foresight to bring her in. They didn't do it, and now she's with the Marlins. Good for her. There's the other guy who is the African-American fellow, the GM of the White Sox. His name is escaping me. Bring him in, fine, great. He's a veteran. Pay him what he wants. Let him run my team. Just bring me a championship. I don't care who you are. I really don't. Just bring me a championship. But with that said, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, baseball has to – you look around, I mean,
very homogenous looking thing. You know, I think if you were to go to the GM meetings, you would see a very homogenous looking group, and that just doesn't reflect America. And we have to do better. If we do better in baseball, we have to do better in society. Absolutely.
Mike, go ahead.
Kenny Williams is now the president of the White Sox, the former general manager. Man, if we could get him, I would love that. I would love that. I'm totally on board with that. But I think the onus is still on organizations to promote and let it be known that, look, we have talented people working for us, and they deserve to have their careers expanded throughout minor league baseball, not just through my organization. So I think the onus is still on organizations to, you know, recruit and provide these people with toolboxes and have them move forward. Some you keep for yourself, some just like minor league prospects, some executives you keep for yourself, some, you know, you push through the system and try to advance their careers. Look at the Mets front office back in the 90s. After Frank Cashin stepped down, at one point we had Jerry Hunsicker, Joe McElvain, Al Harrison, even though he had no fan in any Met then. You know, and then Steve Phillips came through the pipe. Omar Manoa. I mean, there was a lot of executives there within that front office. Some stayed, some left, some came back. And I think more organizations need to do that. Expand their front offices and expand roles and promote from within and advertise throughout the league that, look, we have talented people available here, and there's reasons, little reasons why no one or little of them or few of them are getting jobs. So I think the problem is still wholly baseball's, and it's their responsibility, and they need to come with some kind of proactive effort to promote this and get this done in a smart manner. Otherwise, I got completely thrown off track, so I'll just leave it there, unless there was a specific question.
No, that's good. Rich, I know you wanted to talk about Barstool, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if people saw this. It came out around dinner time, as I saw it, that Major League Baseball is apparently in deep talks with Barstool for them to broadcast. You know, Portnoy, I guess, runs the whole thing, but I guess he's got a cadre of people with him to broadcast some games, you know, similarly to, I guess, the Facebook Watch that happened this year where the Mets were on that at one point. And, you know, I don't know, a few games like maybe ESPN, not Sunday Night Baseball, like ESPN, but to broadcast some games. And the bigger issue is that apparently, if what I'm reading is correct, a part of this would be to promote in-game gambling. It might be a part of it. So as I'm guessing this would play out, you know, you have the Barstool folks and they're, you know, broadcasting Mets Padres, you know, on a June night from Citi Field, whatever it is. And they're talking about, okay, you know, there's a ground ball by Lindor. Okay, he'll be out at first. Hey, folks, you know, as Dom Smith digs into the box here, you could bet right now if this will get a hit. $10 will get you $1,000. If Dom Smith gets a hit, I mean, are we going to see that stuff? I mean, apparently, from what I'm reading, gambling, in-game gambling's a part of it. It would be a part of these broadcasts. I find that deplorable, personally. And, you know, the minute you do that, the minute you sign that deal, if you don't put Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame, it's incredible hypocrisy. Why would you introduce that kind of gambling into your sport and just flaunt it like that? Not to mention, you know, the Barstool thing with Portnoy and all these other people, well, Portnoy in particular, very divisive character. I'll leave it at that. But he is a very divisive character. He's not going to be we just talked about unifying 5 minutes ago. He's not going to do that. You know, if you're getting in bed with this guy, no. He's very polarizing. So between the gambling, between that, you know, I'm reading on Twitter that people are saying, you know, for a sport that's looking to, I don't know, repair its image, grow its popularity, whatever you want to call it, to do this, I mean, this is shocking to me. Like, I almost was waiting for somebody to say this is a Sid Finch story, that I can't believe they're doing this. But apparently they are. I don't know what everybody else thinks.
Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by this. It's happening for a number of reasons. First of all, the other three major sports are entrenched into betting. Remember football, which is the oldest of the old money, was against all kinds of form of it, and then all of a sudden the Dallas Cowboys got in bed to and Jerry Jones, and now that's all what they do. They bet on plays, they bet on the next handoff. It's going to happen. It's just part of the tsunami of our world. The other thing is that Major League Baseball and these sports are trying to draw in other people as to watch the games or pay attention to games that might not be pure fans of that particular sport. And how do you do that? You have to have ancillary products. The majority of people that watch the Super Bowl are probably not as big a fans of the sport as it is the spectacle. And so that's what you're selling now is spectacles. When you're selling images, NFTs, or whatever you want to call them, for $20,000, $30,000, what are we talking about? So this is the way it's going to go. I don't like it, but it's part of accepting it. And the other issue is because our world is being broken up into streams now, it's not like we all turn on Channel 11 or we all turn on Channel 9 like we used to as kids, or you turn on SNY, you're going to see everything. Everything's broken up into streaming. So how do we get people to find the product if they're not so much big fans because they're going to bet? And is it a sellout? Absolutely. Is what they did to Pete Rose contradictory and hypocritical? Absolutely. The difference is when Pete Rose was doing it, the rest of Major League wasn't making money off of it. Now that it can make money off of it, gee, Pete, we're sorry. It's the same thing as legalizing marijuana. We're going to lock you all up for selling marijuana, but wait a minute, now it's legalized. So now it's all cool because instead of calling you were selling weed on an illicit market, they're now calling those people legacy dealers. If you were selling weed back then, you're now a legacy dealer. So it's all good. That's the way big business works.
It's such interesting stuff. As we come to an hour and a half in, I will reset with the Metsian podcast that you have been listening to. I wanna again ask you guys if you have anything else you want to discuss, but I just saw something about Washington Nationals releasing Patrick Corbin after recalling Seth Romero from AA Harrisburg. Rich, I'll start with you. I mean, I haven't seen Patrick Corbin's numbers, but one, it's surprising considering where Patrick Corbin has been in his career. And listen, I'm not about to send a tweet out and get railed for it, and I haven't seen his numbers, and here I am saying it live, where people could potentially rail at me. I don't care. But, the Mets have had pitching problems, and here is a rivalry releasing somebody who has been good in the past. I'm not saying the Mets need to sign him, but they have to do something, right? The problem's offense, obviously.
Well, the problem's kind of pitching, too. Let's be honest. The problem with the Mets, the offense is a bigger problem. But look at, I just wrote the series preview for Metsmerize, and as I do the pitching matchups, two of the starters, Mets are throwing Carrasco tomorrow night, throwing Rich Hill on Wednesday night. You're not going to get more than five innings out of these guys. That's who these guys are. Carrasco obviously is coming back from an injury, but he's a five-inning pitcher today. Rich Hill is a five-inning pitcher today, and next year probably a four-inning pitcher. At 42 years old, he'll be next year. So the pitching isn't exactly great shakes either. So as I look at Patrick Corbin, who I know had a horrible start to the season, then seemed to rebound, his numbers are 6-11. It's the first time hearing of it, so I'm looking at it as we speak. 6-11, 5.83 ERA. He's thrown 122 innings, and he has allowed 134 hits. So that's a lot. And his whip is up around, it's over 1.4. So clearly, he's not having a good year. The question becomes...
Yeah, not good.
Not good. Right. Bad year. There's a reason they released him, obviously. So you take inventory of what you have, and you say to yourself, is this somebody you want to take a shot on? Because as recently as 2019, when they won the World Series, he was 14-7 with a 3.25 ERA. He's not that old. He is, let's see, Corbin is 32 years old. So, and he just turned 32, so he's not exactly an old man. So if you take a shot on somebody like this, just as insurance, then you start to think about who could he be better than what you already have. And I don't know, we'd have to really look at that, but I would not rule out bringing in anybody right now. I'm not saying they have to bring in Corbin. What I'm saying is that take a look at it. Take a look at what this guy is, a lefty. Could he be in the bullpen? Would he be willing to do that? He clearly knows the division. We can make the argument counter-argument division knows him, right? But he's clearly on right. His stock is very down right now. But he's not old. As recently as 2 years ago, he was very good. And given the state of the Mets, and you're throwing the likes of Rich Hill out there, and you're kind of struggling a little bit on the mound, especially in the starting rotation right now. Who knows when Syndergaard's going to be back? Who knows if we're ever going to see DeGrom again this year? Is this worth a gamble? I don't have an answer because it's all fresh information, but it's certainly worth considering, I would say.
Phil, I didn't expect to be talking about Patrick Corbin, but what say you?
What I say is, why not bring him in? Listen, I'm ready to bring in Ray Sadecki and Pat Zachary back if it takes somebody to come on. Where's Mel Rojas? Get him a bus ticket. Get him back here.
Listen,
you know, man.
I'll always bring Pat Zachary in for his beard alone, honestly.
Okay. But, you know, listen, bring them all in, man. We have 60 days left in the season to figure this out. I was tired of watching the Phillies mush us in the face and laugh at us, knock the ice cream cone we just bought from our hand on the street and look at us this weekend. It was disgusting. If we're going to lose, at least go out fighting. We went out like punks. And I am tired of it. That's why my ire is toward the players, because you're on the field looking these people across from you on the diamond. You're looking at the guy on the mound that's dissing you and flipping your nose up. You don't have enough gumption to go do anything about it. And we're talking about Sandy Alderson and the manager. I'd be like, if I was a player, I'd be like, listen, man, guys, we're getting smacked around here. Who's going to do something about it? And maybe it takes Baez to start a fight for this team or something, but that's where I'm at as a Met fan. I'm at my wit's end, and it's disgusting watching the product right now.
Mike, did we lose Mike going once, going twice?
No, you didn't lose me. I just muted.
That mute button.
Sorry. But sure, bring in Corbin. Bring in anybody who can help. But the other side to that is, whose roster spot is that going to affect? You know, at what price do you bring in Corbin? Who has to, you know, bite the dust on that one? That's my first question. But if he can help, if anybody can help, you know, the returnees from injuries, if Carrasco can elevate his game a little bit, and if we get DeGrom back, you know, look, we got 9 games against Miami, 8 against Washington. We don't face Philly and Atlanta again till the end of the season. So us, Philly, Atlanta, we're all on our own. We have to all make our own way to the end of the season, and hopefully we're all in the pack. And when we do finally face each other again to close out the season, those games will be decisive. Hopefully we'll come out on the winning end. But let us not forget these 13 games coming up against the L.A. Dodgers and the Giants. I was hoping that the Mets would be a lot better. I was hoping that the Mets would do a lot better than 11-17 heading into these games, cycling back to the Pittsburgh series. This I hadn't anticipated. This is a setback. So we got to persevere through the rest of the month. And like I said, us, Philly, Atlanta, we're all taking our own route now to the end of September till we meet again. And, you know, we have to make the best of it, because the only way to get into the playoffs is to win the National League East.
Yep.
That it is. guys, you know, we're getting into the potential last half hour, but I don't anticipate it going that far. And I'll start with you, Phil, as to whether you have any outstanding things that you would like to talk about.
You know, I go back to my guttural reaction as a Mets fan, and beyond trying to analyze what's going on with this team and point out to patterns and all that kind of stuff, we're all on this podcast, and those who are lucky enough to be listening to us, we are all Mets fans, bottom line. And I could give a rat's ass on what they do, just get it done. Do I have the answers? Absolutely not. Does anybody on this podcast have the answers? No, we have suggestions. We have thoughts like everybody else. But we are frankly tired of coming down to it. And August plays a massive month in Mets history. It was August in 1969. This came from last to first. You know, it was August in 1973. This team was from last to first. In 1986, we didn't need anything. I think it was 1999. August played a critical month in us. In 2015, it played a crucial month for us. And also the opposite way, where September has been times we spit the bit. In 07, we spit the bit. Remember those, that series at the end of the year with Tom Glavine on the mound? I mean, we've had some really bad Septembers as well. So I can't even forecast what's going to happen with this team because they have yet to produce. And they showed no fight to me. So I'm really kind of down, and I have no optimism for the rest of this season on what we're going to do. But as a Mets fan, I just want to say this sucks. I need somebody to fix it. I don't know who, but somebody, for God's sake, fix this shit, please.
Seriously, yeah. To whoever is listening out there, no matter what you believe in, I'll go around the horn. Rich.
Yeah, in terms, did anybody see, I don't know, if you're asking for general topics, just lighten the mood a bit. Did anybody see the video of the fan who ran on the field at Dodger Stadium? Did you guys see this?
Yeah. Yes, I did. Yeah.
You have to Google it. It sounds like you all did. My God. So the guys, I just saw the view from the upper deck. I've never seen that particular one before. I just saw it moments ago. And you can get a great perspective. And it literally looks like a guy returning a kick. You know, he's got everybody beat. And then the ball girl just, she deliberately, you know, she scouted him out, like she moved along with him. And then when he got close, she went down through the shoulder, and he went tumbling over the stands and was detained. Yeah. I mean, that was awesome. I loved that.
I called it a hockey hip check into the boards.
There you go. Good for her.
Yeah.
But I think we've covered the major stuff here. I think I'll throw this out. Dodgers Giants 13 in a row. I'm so sick of hearing about that. You know, I watched the Pirates, and yes, I know the Pirates also beat the Mets. I watched the Pirates 2 weekends ago take 2 out of 3 from the Giants. So I don't want to hear anything about them being invincible or any of that nonsense. You know, you play them, you have a chance to beat them. Same with the Dodgers. But with that said, I mean, my God, these 3 games against Washington. You know, the Mets have the pitching advantage every game. Yes, I met Carrasco and Hill are short starters, but they still have the pitching advantage. The Nationals basically have no players left. You know, the names you'll recognize are Robles, are Juan Soto, and Josh Bell, but they're, that's about it. And Mets really have, I mean, you hate to say you have to sweep because you all know how difficult that is, but they really have to, you know, at minimum 2 out of 3, of course, but they really have to think about that. That's what differentiates teams that don't win from teams that they do. When you get to this time of the year where the team you're playing has packed it in, you know, they've obviously traded everybody. You've got to just kick them hard. And, you know, the Braves took 2 out of 3. They didn't sweep them, but now that the Nationals are here, the Mets have to right the ship here, and they've really got to just unleash their fury on the Washington Nationals. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, your mouth to the Metsian God's ears. Mike, where are you on it? Everything. Wherever you want to go. It's there, Mike. You can press it. He's there.
I did it again. I'm sorry. Well, I'm going to keep hammering the point home that, you know, Phil and I have been doing all night. The Mets have to hit more. And it's the core. It's not just one or two people. It's all of them, really. It's Alonzo, Smith, McNeil, Conforto, and then when Lindor and Baez get back, you know, together, they need to get this done. And I hope to the high holy heavens that Tawan Walker is a quality performer down the stretch. Because even with Jacob DeGrom back, even with Marcus Stroman, without a productive Tawan Walker, I think we might come up just a tad bit short. I have been riddled with anxiety over his second half. Today's game, I should say, made me feel just a tiny bit bitter over his situation. But the hitting has got to come through. We're bottom tier in all offensive categories for reasons. So that has to improve. All of them collectively. Not just one or two, all of them. Because we think this is the core. We are talking about the core. We're talking about not just one, two, three, or four players. We're talking five and six up and down the lineup that we thought coming into the season would be productive and competitive and vying for a playoff spot. Well, here we are, mid-August, a couple of games out of first place. We spent most of the season in first place. Hopefully the battle is back and forth, and let's see who winds out on top. Man, do they have to have a good, good next 5 weeks before they face the Atlanta Braves and Phillies again.
That they do. You have been listening to the Metsian podcast, and if anybody has anything outstanding, I'm going to, throw the gauntlet down when going once, going twice.
I just want to add one thing to this whole mix. You know, we talk about what happened to the clubhouse, and I don't want to kind of make it like he was a major play, but Todd Frazier being in the Mets clubhouse meant something. You remember when they brought him back last year? He came and kind of gave a surge to the dugout. One thing we have, we talk about Lindor being leadership, is veteran leadership. Guys to sit people like Alonzo Smith down and say, guys, listen, through the course of your career, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. This is how we handle that. I don't think we have that on this team. When you're going through a really rough period and someone to grab the reins of the runaway stagecoach and guide it. And I think that's something to be said on who's going to take the reins of the final days of the season for this team in that clubhouse and do that.
Great point. Anybody?
Well, although he's not a veteran, Pete Alonso has kind of, you know, positioned himself that way. He calls himself the best power hitter in baseball. He's certainly very vocal, and that's great, but okay. Maybe it's time for him to show some leadership. Throwing it out there.
Phil, I got to toss it back to you. You were talking about him, quote-unquote, horsing around.
Yeah, you know, my issue with Pete is, listen, he needs to put everything in perspective. You hit 53 home runs. I'm so happy for that. You hit it in a season where the ball was juiced. So, you know, let's put that in perspective. Pete Alonso is not a kid. He's 26 years old, but sometimes he acts a little goofy. And I think to say that at the All-Star game, where the team is littered with the event is littered with the best players in baseball, when have you ever heard another player at the game sound better than everybody else that is here? Never. So when you sound the best power hitter in baseball, well, what does that mean? That means duty squat. If you said I'm the best clutch hitter in baseball, that means something because normally you have the stats to back that up. So, Pete, put down the horses. Stop making up a fake hitting instructor, whatever his name was. You want to put the earphones in and bop your head. You want to have a graffiti bat and hit home runs. And you want to posture in front of everybody. This is New York City. If you – sorry, Pete, when we finish writing it, you can read that to find out which way you should act while you're here. You ain't done duty squat. Lead your team. Lead by example. Stop all the goofiness because when you're losing – the people like me that's going to point it out, and you don't want to hear it at that point. So I don't know what he said the other day that you was alluded to, but I'd like to hear what he said the other day.
You mean
great? Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
I mean, I could read it to you if you want. Is that what you want, Phil?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. I didn't hear what he said.
All right, let me hold on 1 second. Let me grab that. I have it. It's actually in my article that I wrote today. So I'll pull that up. Okay, so this is after the game. Pete was asked, what's going on with the team and all that. And his exact quote is, okay, all of us have jobs to do. All of us have jobs that we do. And for me, I'm lucky. I'm blessed that this is my job. But my job is on TV, and this past week, it was a rough week for me, no doubt, for sure. But everybody comes home from a bad day at work. Everybody has a bad day at work. And even though you're trying giving your best at work or whatever your profession, you could try, and you could really dive into it and hope that you turn things around. You guys are reporters, writers. I mean, there's such a thing as writer's block. I was a history major. I had a ton of stuff I had to write in college. There's certain times in the process when you know you're doing the right thing, you know you're on the right path, but you're just not getting tangible results. Mets fans, believe in us. And don't just believe, no, because there's tough times, not just in baseball, but in life in general. Know that this is just a speed bump and a challenge. And also smile. You get to watch baseball. It's a game. I know we have the most passionate fan base in baseball. I know that. And I understand that it's frustrating. It's frustrating for us. But just understand that we're here together. We're all in this together. We got this. We got this. Just smile and know we got this. That's his quote.
I think when you're young and immature and don't understand that there was a world of things that happened before you started taking breath on this earth and before people started paying attention to you, that people are talking about things we have seen and understand. So when Pete Alonso is trying to rewrite history and rewrite how fans act and treat things, yet you said you were the best at something in a sport full of hundreds of players over 100-plus years have played this game, but today I'm the best. And then you're sitting there saying, give me patience? No! You open up the door, and now your big foot is in your mouth. So spit the cleats out and get a fucking base hit.
Well, that's what Todd Deal said, Phil, right after Pete was on TV saying this, go to the studio. And Todd Deal said it came off as disingenuous. It came off as patronizing. It's like we see this. We know what's happening. Don't come back at us and say, we've got this. Just go smile. Go away. You know, you're passionate. That's all nice and well and good. Don't talk down to the fans like that. We spend our money on this shit. You know, we spend tons of people buy your stuff. I mean, just take some accountability. Like Todd Deal says over and over every show. Just say, look, I had a chance to get it done yesterday, didn't get it done yesterday. Had a chance to get it done today, didn't get it done today. Folks, I'm going to work my ass off for you and try to be the best I can. That's all. That's all we're looking for. But this came off as patient.
Absolutely.
Mike, I feel like we need to hear from you on this.
No, I have nothing more to add. I'm in lockstep with Rich and Phil. Phil said it perfectly.
Why, thank you, everybody. Again, I'm going to go back to Phil for one more shameless plug. Thank you, Phil Maillard, Tomorrow Media film director. Please tell the audience one more time where they can find you.
Well, we can go to Tomorrow Media, TUMAROMEDIA.com. That's our website. You can see what we're doing there. We have a number of projects we're trying to develop, a couple of baseball ones, including surrounding around the Mets, but I'll keep that for another day when we get closer to fruition. But I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in, and I can speak for everybody on this podcast that we all feel your pain. We all feel your pain. Some of us have been feeling a little longer than others, but we all feel your pain. And I want to just say to the guys in the podcast, Rich, Mike, Sam, I truly enjoy the repartee, the conversation with this, and I hope more people join in to listening to this, because it's very fascinating, and I think it's cathartic at the same time.
Exactly. Even though it's an off night, the Mets are on our minds. It sounds like I'm starting to write a song about them. Anyway, we'll have to. That's for another discussion another day. Thank you again, Phil. And I'm going to go to Mike Lacolant next. Yeah, thank you again. Please, Mike, take it away. Final words.
Final words? I tell you what, I'm going to have a little fun and a shameless plug. Yesterday, August 8th, 1914, the Brooklyn Royal Giants defeated the New York Police Department at Suburban Oval over at McDonald Avenue and 16th Avenue. That's it.
Yes. I'm gonna have to look at your website. You know what? Let's go around the horn. Please tell the audience where they can find you, Mr. Brooklyn Trolley Blogger.
That's it. The Brooklyn Trolley Blogger.blogspot.com. And like I said, I've been spending the summer recapping old Negro League games, Brooklyn Eagles, Brooklyn Royal Giants, Brooklyn Semi-Pros. Like I always say, if it happens in Brooklyn, I'm trying to cover it. And I had a fun game recapping yesterday's game against the Brooklyn Royal Giants and the New York Police.
Beautiful. We got to take a look at that. Thank you so much, man. And let's go up to Connecticut, up 95. And Rich, I would like both your final word as well as your shameless plug.
So my shameless plug is Mesmerized Online. I do the history stuff. In fact, did one today. It was 2 years ago today that Michael Conforto lost his shirt, so I write the history pieces, and I split the series previews with another writer. So, yeah, right. Can you believe it? 2 years ago today was the first shirt ripping. And then my final word is sweep. You know, I hate to have to say that because I know it's tough to sweep a major league team, but you know what? The Mets have to generate some momentum. They're playing a team that is mailing it in, essentially, at least in terms of their desire to compete this year. And enough, you know, 2 out of 3 would be kissing your sister. That's not good enough. They've got to kick their ass. They've got to make a statement before they go into those 13 games against the Dodgers and the Giants. So sweep is my last word.
Couldn't agree more. I would just say converted Mets fan, Bedford and Sullivan, everybody take a look, Google it, what have you, Twitter it. And my name is Sam Maxwell. My final word is cathartic. One way or another, I feel like Phil just said there is something cathartic about these stretches, that you know that there will be change on the other side. But at the same time, the Mets aren't completely dead in the water. As much as they have looked it on fastballs. But still, you got to believe. You got to keep the faith. If you look at this division as 1973, it's there for the Mets taking. And where you got to believe was born can also be reborn here in the new era of Steve Cohen. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to the Metsian podcast, and there's only one other way that we end this, and that's by saying, let's go Mets. Take care, everybody. Thank you,
Take
Phil.
Care,
thank you, Rich.
Yes.
Thank you, Mike.
Good night. Good night, Phil.
Thank
Great
you, audience.
Good night, Rich. Good night, Sam.
Good night, guys.